Welcome back to Drilling Deeper, a Pit & Quarry podcast. I'm Kevin Yannick, editor-in-chief of Pit & Quarry magazine. Once again, my friend and colleague, Jack Kapansky, our managing editor. Jack, how you doing?
Good, Kevin. How you been?
Doing well. Down here in the downtown Cleveland office, fall seems to be here. 6 months of gray, I guess, ahead for Cleveland. That's just the norm, right, in Northeast Ohio?
Yeah, I don't mind when it cools down, but yeah, when that sun starts going down at like 5-6 o'clock, that's when I'm starting to get the wintertime blues.
Yeah, it seemed like the sun was about to be going down on our local Cleveland Browns here, but they eked out a win over San Francisco recently, and up and down, but it's a good week to be a Browns fan, at least as we're recording our second podcast here.
It was great. It was great as a Browns fan, not so great as a San Francisco spread better. But you know, I'll take what I can get. Obviously, a win's a win, and better to be 3-2 than 2-3. So
yeah, well, our office down here is about 3 blocks from Cleveland Browns Stadium, and you know, we've been busy. Obviously, it's the fourth quarter here, and we're kind of working on our year end December State of the Industry issue at Pit & Quarry. You know, in recent weeks, like probably a week or two ago, we got our October 2023 print edition, you know, left on our desks. That's our buyer's guide. So anybody looking to purchase equipment, find vendors, new vendors, contact information for old vendors, you know, that is now available to you. And just last week, we wrapped up our November edition. We're always, you know, on the go, I guess we're always kind of looking back a little bit, but for the most part, once we put an issue out, we're looking ahead to the next one. And even though as we're recording this, it's still October, we're kind of all minds on December.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially in sort of these every quarter months where it's not only a Pit & Quarry month, but we have our sister publication, Portable Plants, going out as well. And so it's sort of a double workload in that front. But yeah, like you said, we closed November last week, 2 weeks ago. And yeah, I feel like the next day you were already in the team's group saying, hey, got this feature ready for, you know, it's up on the server, ready to go. It definitely seems like we're always working on something. There's not a whole lot of downtime, but I think we kind of like it that way.
I like it that way. I think it's important to celebrate your victories now and then. I remember years ago, because New England, the Patriots, you know, they've won, what, 6 Super Bowls with Belichick and Brady. I think I remember reading a story about how, you know, Belichick would maybe celebrate a Super Bowl victory for that evening after the game, and then the next morning he's back in his office planning the next day. And you know, we're not exactly that at Pit & Quarry. I mean, we're kind of looking ahead a little bit always, but you know, you have to take time and celebrate your victories now and then. And yeah, it's kind of crazy, we're already, you know, 10-11 issues down for Pit & Quarry this year. Pit & Quarry, we're in our 108th year, I guess it would be, and still going strong, Jack.
Yeah, you know, and I think the nice thing about that is, you know, even with some of the short turnarounds that can sometimes, you know, be a little stressful, I think the nice thing is there never seems to be a shortage of talking points or a shortage of things going on within the industry for us to write about. So that's the nice thing, is that we never have to dig too deep, or should I say drill too deep, to find relevant topics or relevant stories to tell. So that definitely makes it easier for us. And I know you've, again, being around as long as you have developed a plethora of great connections and a lot of people that are awesome to work with and will, you know, are great sources for stories. And I'm developing my own network as well. So I think, you know, we're never at a loss, which is nice.
Yeah. One storyline we've been keeping tabs on in recent years is the supply chain. You know, as we mentioned in episode 1 of our Drilling Deeper podcast, Pit & Quarry is the authority on equipment and technology. That's the tagline that you see at the top of every cover of Pit & Quarry magazine that goes out monthly. And the supply chain, while very normal, I guess you could argue if you want to call it that, for the longest time, it experienced a lot of disruption coming out of COVID and, you know, the year or two after that. And some things still seem disrupted in a way, because our industry is in a good position. Our readers, the agri producers out there, they're busy, they're crushing rock. That means that their equipment and technology, you know, needs to be addressed. You know, they're looking to make upgrades, buy new plants, buy new equipment, even though the economic environment might not necessarily be super conducive to all that right now, with interest rates being at highs we haven't seen, you know, since you were a young lad, Jack. But, you know, our industry is doing really well. But that said, because of demand, the demand for equipment right now is kind of causing a little bit of disruption still. And yeah, as I mentioned, we've just put out our October issue. And we wrapped up our November issue, which should be hitting mailboxes here come the next month. And you've been talking about that in a couple of articles that you put out in Pit and Corey. So maybe you can share a little bit about what it is you learned from some of the sources that you talked with on supply chain and what's happening out there.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely an interesting kind of dichotomy to look at, where the supply chain is kind of writing itself from a parts perspective, where manufacturers are able to get their hands on the things they need to make the equipment. Producers are able to more easily get replacement parts for their equipment. But that almost sort of caused its own set of problems, with manufacturers now able to make the equipment they need. That sort of spiked the demand, or has led to an increased spike in demand that was already pretty high for producers wanting to get their hands on this equipment. I know I spoke with a manufacturer for one of these stories I was doing, and he made a point to say that they have product lines that are 12 months out for orders, and it's been that way for about 18 months now. And in working with their dealers, they have orders placed through the end of 2024, and project orders are extending into 2025. So we're seeing lead times sort of ballooning a little bit again, but not from the causes we've been seeing before. There's so much demand for equipment that can't necessarily get into the hands of producers fast enough. Where, you know, I asked that same manufacturer, I'm like, that kind of seems like a good problem to have. And I think to an extent it is, but he was a little maybe hesitant to put it in those words, that, you know, it's certainly good to have demand, but, you know, as a manufacturer, you want to obviously be able to supply as many people as you can. But it's an interesting spot to be in, because there was a producer that I talked with that had mentioned he ordered a skid steer on a Tuesday and he expected to get it on Friday. So there's parts and pieces that you're seeing a vast shift in from how it was two and a half, three years ago. But for a whole new set of reasons, there's still going to be a pretty big wait time on certain pieces of equipment that I think producers are more able to plan for now because of some of the problems that they experienced during COVID.
That's the key. I think you just touched on it at the end there, Jack. I mean, it's planning. And we've talked about CapEx projects and supply chain at our annual Pit and Corey Roundtable and conference the last couple of years. You know, this has kind of been a hot topic, where, as we used to operate in a just-in-time world, where, you know, if you want a portable crusher, you want that skid steer you talked about, you know, you call your dealer, you tell them what it is you need, and it's going to be there when you need it, before you need it. Nowadays, you know, we're talking about lead times for some manufacturers that are not just stretching into 2024, which, you know, we're in the fourth quarter, that's not surprising, but, you know, into 2025. I kind of agree with your original thought there, and talking to that one manufacturer, that is good and bad. I mean, it's bad because, you know, if you're that producer in need of the crusher, the conveying component, the conveyor, you want it today. And, you know, if you can't get it from manufacturer A, you're going to shop around to get it from somebody else. But again, it kind of goes to show that there's such demand right now for equipment. People want equipment. And despite, again, the economic environment surrounding it, they're ready to go out and make investments. They're not necessarily afraid to put the money out there. Like we saw probably in 2020, maybe even leaking into 2021. And our industry obviously has an infrastructure bill, a federal one, $1.2 trillion that were put aside directly for federal infrastructure projects at the end of 2021. And we've seen a lot of states investing in infrastructure legislation, and that's given producers, Pit and Corey readers, a lot of confidence to go out and make these types of investments. But, you know, it is a little frustrating, I guess, if you're, you know, ready to make a purchase. And in some cases, you know, we're talking, these are not, you know, nickel and dime purchases. These are big, massive investments. You know, if you're buying a new plant, you know, trying to invest in a new plant, you're talking about many millions of dollars to try to get something like that off the ground. So, you know, I could see why manufacturers are trying to get a little bit creative to do things to accommodate the market at this stage.
And I think one thing I've seen and one thing I've heard is sort of a similar trend to what I saw when I first joined the magazine back in late 21, when, you know, lead times and supply chains were still double, triple, quadruple what they were pre-COVID. And because of these ballooning lead times again, producers are resorting to other ways to get equipment, whether it's renting, refurbishing old equipment, buying used, you know, so there's definitely again, that demand is so high that producers are kind of doing whatever they can to stay on top of it. And again, going back to my story from October, that same manufacturer I talked with had mentioned that their dealers are increasing their rental fleet, and those dealers' rental utilization is up to almost 90% at this point. And that's kind of been the way to go, because there may not always be the quality of used equipment on the market. And, you know, if someone needs to get a job done, it's easier to, and potentially more cost effective, to say, let me get this crusher, let me get this screen for X amount of days, weeks, months, do the job, give it back, and then, you know, go from there. That, I think, highlights one of the most impressive things about this industry that I've seen since I've come on board. It's the resilience, and it's the sort of creativity of this industry to say, all right, this isn't going to work. What's plan B? What's plan C? And just sort of going down the road, because it's not a matter of this isn't something that can't get done. This has to get done. So we need to find a way to make it work. And however they have to, they'll do what they need to.
Yeah, where there's a will, there's a way. The people of the aggregate industry, you know, despite these problems, and, you know, we hear it regularly in talking with sources, we hear it at our annual roundtable, you know, there's frustration there in the inability to access the things that you want when you want them. But producers find a way. Some of the most tenacious people in the country, they will work a problem. They will, you know, fabricate a plant themselves, do what the things they need to do in order to ensure the longevity of their operations, to ensure the sustainability of them, and make sure that those things keep running. Jack, one other note that was included in one of your stories, I think it was the October one that we put out here recently, was, you know, the idea that manufacturers, not necessarily the dealers, but one dealer had kind of mentioned to us in recent months that he was looking at the manufacturers to kind of figure out ways to increase capacity. And, you know, we've seen examples of that, you know, whether it's investing in new facilities or kind of transitioning old facilities and making them something else. You know, there was one instance we talked about recently where somebody shifted some of their remanufacturing and repairs to another facility to try to streamline some efficiency. So I think we are seeing some of that. That is a little bit of a trend in terms of, you know, manufacturers trying to find ways to meet the demand, meeting the demand by finding ways to put more product down these production lines at the end of the day, having more production lines even.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you mentioned, the company that sort of shifted really from one state to another their entire remanufacturing and repair capabilities to one of their distribution facilities. And, you know, they're just utilizing the space they have on hand. They got 50,000 square feet in this facility, and this now allows them to sort of have one home base now. So it's a cost saver, it's a quality control thing, but it also allows them to sort of get more hands-on with these remanufactures and repairs, as equipment is sort of harder to come by and more people might be inclined to say, all right, this piece is a little older, I could buy new, but if I send it in, I can maybe get a few more years out of this one before I need to buy again. Let's opt for that route. So, and you also mentioned expansion. I know we've written one or two pieces about Superior's expansion in Prescott Valley, Arizona, where they're adding a fourth production line. Their need for portable plants production is going up. Their need for just overall production capacity is going up. So they're, you know, they're expanding that. And I know there's countless other companies, both domestic and abroad, that are doing the same thing, whether it's to house more parts and equipment, whether it's to increase their production capacity. Yeah, everybody, it seems like everybody on every front, producers, manufacturers, dealers, are doing everything they can to have more equipment on hand and be able to produce more equipment just to meet this insane demand.
Right. The supply chain is an interesting dynamic. Obviously, you got manufacturers on the very starting point and dealers who are distributing equipment and wear parts and goods to the end market, which would be the agri producers, the readers of Pit and Quarry. And each one of those cogs in the chain is essentially looking to another one to do a little bit more. But at the end of the day, nobody really wants to bear the cost of having those things on hand, having so much inventory on hand. But one dynamic that I've heard more and more of late is that if you don't have it, you can't sell it. You know, whether that's the manufacturer or the dealer, it seems like there's a lot more aggressiveness on the dealer front, maybe even in particular, to make sure that they have things on hand, because if they don't, they're going to have to get at the back of these long lines you're talking about, Jack, where those lead times are weeks and weeks and months and months. So I think people have, for the most part in our industry, adjusted to this new normal that we're operating in. But, you know, you even referenced one producer in your October Road to Prosperity story about having a warehouse, I think, on site to make sure that there's enough components and wear parts on hand so that you're not having to wait 24, 48 hours, you know, for your dealer to drive on out and deliver that stuff. So it's interesting how we've adjusted with the supply chain since COVID. Don't know if this is where we're going to stay. Maybe we shift back to just in time. I don't think anybody knows, but I think the key right now is just staying on top of things as they are and continuous adjustments along the way, it seems.
Yeah. And if we would have hopped on here in 2020, 2021, and one of us would have told the other that there was a producer out there that was able to, again, like you said, fill a warehouse, have, you know, have doubles, have triples, and then some of, you know, different parts, we'd probably ask them what secret sauce or what MJ's secret stuff they were using to make them able to get their hands on all that. So yeah, it is definitely a shift. And, you know, that, like you mentioned, the sort of just in time has kind of gone away. And, you know, looking at the, again, sort of the good news, bad news of this, you know, mentioning Superior, I spoke with Johnny Garrison for one of these stories, and he basically said that he doesn't anticipate this going away soon. He said, "We're going into our second and third year of record levels of demand and equipment. I think there's a feeling across the industry now that this is going to stick around for a while. It's not a one-year boom. This is going to be a 3 to 5 year boom." So clearly from someone who is, you know, dealing directly with this demand and seeing firsthand how intense, you know, they're working to help meet this demand and help produce enough equipment, certainly doesn't sound like this is going away anytime soon.
No, when I think about 2023 for the agri industry, in some ways it feels very much like 2022. It was very healthy for the most part. When we talk to people, Jack, I don't really feel like I ever talk to somebody who says, "This year is terrible. This year sucks." You hear things are good. It's hard to find people, but we're putting materials out. We're selling things. It's still relatively good. I think it's interesting to note when we look at some of the production numbers that we get from the U.S. Geological Survey and some of the reports that we look on from Dodge Construction Network. I know I'm regularly looking at some of the monthly stuff that the Lake Carriers Association is publishing because, you know, they're keeping tabs on limestone as it goes out on the Great Lakes in Michigan, Ohio, and Ontario, Canada. It seems like volumes are down. So aggregate volumes are down. And I've noticed that for, you know, 3 or 4 quarters in a row now, which originally was making me think, are we not in a good place? Are things kind of downturning so much? But at the end of the day, kind of what's happened out there is we essentially had peaks, you know, in 21 and 22 in terms of volumes, you know, peaks that in terms of aggregate production, crushed stone, sand and gravel production that we hadn't seen since the Great Recession. And year after year, production numbers just crept up to, you know, unbelievable levels that we hadn't seen in a while. And yes, aggregate production numbers are down of late, but they're still in a relatively healthy position historically. You know, when you think back to the Great Recession and some of those really down years of 08, 09, those are before your time and my time on Pit and Quarry, Jack, but we, you know, hear horror stories, you know, when, you know, we're out and about and guys are reflecting on those times. But all that to say is that, you know, while production's down, it seems like there's still plenty of production out there to be had. There's enough infrastructure projects out there that are going on. Although, you know, we hear about slowdowns here and there. You know, our industry is very much regional, but I guess the point I'm trying to say is our industry is in a good position. You know, maybe we're not at the peak levels in terms of production that we had of 21 and 22, but, you know, here in 23, it's a good place to be.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, talking about the health of the industry. I think back to the 2022 Pit and Quarry Roundtable that we had, and There was a manufacturer that was in my room, and we were talking about, you know, again, how the industry was kind of thriving even amidst, you know, some lingering pandemic issues. And he was very to the point when he said, if you're not doing well, if you're not thriving right now, you're doing something wrong. And it was about as staunch of a sort of statement on how well the industry is doing as a whole as I had heard to that point. And really, even in the year plus that's followed since our summer roundtable in 2022, it's been more of the same, if not even more increased, with how thriving everyone throughout the industry is doing.
Yeah, I think the term that we hear a lot is cautious optimism. I think that's where our industry continues to be. We're going to be reporting a little bit about the state of affairs, the state of the industry in our December 2023 edition that we're putting out here and not too long from now, but it seems like the agri industry continues always on this slow but steady course. you know, you can't expect to be doubling production. You know, plants are only capable of doing so much, but there's enough for everybody out there to be had. And again, you know, like you said, if you're not doing well, you're doing something wrong. And, you know, from time to time, you do see agri-producing companies and those supporting them on the vendor side fade away. But again, kind of par for the course for our industry as it stands right now versus past years, recent years.
Yeah, and you kind of got to see some of that success and some of those real-world cases firsthand recently. I know you recently were on some travels visiting a couple producers, visiting some spots, sort of being the man about town recently. So what kind of stuck out to you most? You know, tell us about some of those travels you had, what you saw, and what kind of your main takeaways were.
Yeah, it's been a busy travel stretch for me lately. I'm trying to think of all the places I've been, you know, from Nashville to Jackson, Mississippi. We were in Washington. Rob Fullup, our publisher, Dino Vitanza, our associate publisher, and I for the NSSGA Legislative and Policy Forum right at the end of September, and was up in Minnesota not too long ago either, visiting with a couple producers. And I think that's one of the beauties of getting out there and being a part of these events, being a part of the industry and being out and about, is that, you know, you're able to kind of tabulate what it is people are feeling. Again, our industry is very local or regional. Not every economic indicator affects everybody else. What happens in the Southeast doesn't necessarily impact what happens here in Cleveland necessarily, but taking the, you know, some of the sentiment that I gathered from those trips, maybe I'll start with Minnesota. I was up there with, you know, with Fisher Mining, Nick Oster, who's been at our round table at least once or twice. You know, he was showing me a new plant that they've got, and he was talking about the market there in Minneapolis. And it seems like it's a growth market, one of those growth markets for the country for aggregates. Fisher's an example. They've got a pretty old plant there in Apple Valley, Minnesota. And in recent years, I think 5 years ago, they made an investment in a new plant not too far away. It's in Empire Township, Minnesota, to kind of keep their aggregate business flowing to support their ready mix business. That's essentially what the majority of their materials are supporting. But, you know, Nick kind of shared how much of their market is kind of based on, you know, residential and the non-residential side, and feeling out residential of late has been interesting. Is, I think, what we were all expecting for a while there was that it was just going to crash. You know, interest rates started ticking upward a year and a half, 2 years ago, and buyers were getting skittish, but it seems like they're still building homes, and that's the case in Minneapolis. It seems like that metro area is just making its way outward even more. And that's creating opportunities for producers to support the growth there. Where there's residential going up, they need schools, they need retail, they need businesses to keep those communities thriving. And you know, it seems like there's a good story there in Minneapolis, with Fisher Mining and some of the other producers that are tapping into that market. I was visiting too with Cody Ladd during my Minneapolis visit. Cody recently joined Kramer Mining Materials, and he's the COO of that company. You know, he came on board. He's an M&A guy at the end of the day. And, you know, we were talking about not just kind of what's happening in the Minneapolis market, but what, Kramer is trying to do there, whether it's in Minnesota or elsewhere. So our conversation there talked a lot about their desire to kind of replicate the operation that they have in the Minneapolis area and purchase another operation or expand via M&A. Could be within Minnesota, could be outside of Minnesota, but we're always keeping tabs of some of the transactions that are taking place in the industry. It's been a little bit slower of late here in 23. You know, we haven't really seen a ton of big deals, but we did see recently Summit Materials purchase Argos USA on the cement side, and that's something we can get into a little bit. But again, I guess being out there in Minnesota, you know, doing these travels just kind of reinforced that our industry is in a really good position. You know, Cody there at Kramer was talking about the desire there to be very bullish. I asked him about the financing environment, and that's not necessarily scaring him off. Maybe it's scaring off some other buyers in the U.S. or sellers potentially who don't want to sell their business at this time. But there's still appetite for M&A, it seems, and we'll have more on Kramer Mining Materials and my interview with Cody in our November edition. We'll also have more with Cody and their plant manager in our December edition, as I got a tour of their plant and saw some of the cutting edge investments that they made in that operation not too long ago that has allowed for the ability to kind of do something a little bit different and try to expand the business in some way.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're out a lot more frequently than I am visiting these producers and seeing these sites. But I think both of those are great examples of kind of what we talked about with the health and success of the industry, where you see with Fisher sort of that resourcefulness of capitalizing on what's going on in residential in their area and really making that a point where they can, you know, thrive and grow in their own right. And then you look at Kramer with Cody Ladd. I mean, you know, M&A has obviously been sort of booming the last few years, maybe not as strongly this year as it was in 2022 or 21, but nonetheless, he wouldn't be looking to grow and be as bullish with that growth as you mentioned were it not for them doing well. So I think those are two really great case studies to show, yes, this industry is doing well. Yes, there's, you know, a great future ahead, and let's hope that it stays that way.
As you know, Jack, as many of our readers do too, we have a partnership with FMI Capital Advisors. You know, they keep our readers abreast of what's happening with mergers and acquisitions. And at our roundtable every year, we have George Redden, who will deliver a forecast for the year ahead on construction materials. You know, as I put together this story on Kramer, again, it's kind of an M&A business type of story. And I went back and looked at some of the data that FMI has shared with Pitt & Corey of late about construction materials transactions, you know, M&A type of deals. And it has slowed of late. You know, think about a couple of years ago, we saw Martin Marietta make, you know, a really big deal on the West Coast, acquiring Hansen's Western assets. Vulcan Materials did another one with U.S. Concrete. You know, these are some really, really big deals, you know, in the billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar range. And for the most part, 2023's been not so much that. It's been producers who are looking to buy, tacking on via bolt-on acquisitions, you know, operations, enhancing existing territories that have, not seeing a whole lot of platform type deals or, you know, those thunderclap deals that I know as George describes them. Nonetheless, it seems like there's still desire out there among producers like a Kramer to go out there and find out where there are areas to grow. The growth in our industry is somewhat limited. And it's interesting as you go out to Minneapolis and other metropolitan areas, all these obviously need construction materials. All of them have quarries, whether they're in the metro market or outside, and materials are being trucked or railed or barged in. We're probably going to see, you know, more of the same, I would think, with bolt-ons and maybe a limited number of platform-type deals or thunderclaps. But yeah, like you said, Jack, it's kind of exciting to see that the industry is not stagnant. You know, they're willing to go out there and find ways to expand. I guess kind of what I was trying to say earlier, too, is that the pathway to growth in our industry has been kind of confined to M&A, you know, buying another business, finding that family business owner or somebody who's looking to offload an asset and acquiring it via some sort of deal where you're getting, you know, an FMI or some sort of advisory services company involved with that transaction. In Minnesota, it seemed like there's a little bit more opportunity maybe on the greenfield front. Greenfield, if you don't know out there, it's starting a quarry from scratch, essentially finding a property, getting it permitted, zoned. And that's been a years-long process in recent years, becoming much more difficult. So it seems like companies that are looking to grow, they're looking at that M&A route as the means. And my trip to Minnesota and kind of just recent conversations just reinforce that's where we are as a means to grow.
Yeah, you know, and among those travels and kind of a different kind of merger, if you will, you know, you recently visited with Brian Full and Steve Zelnak over at Sunrock Sykes, two real industry titans that, you know, at one point, as I kind of learned from reading your part one of your interview with them, that, you know, we're kind of industry rivals, if you will, kind of working against each other, and now they're working together, and just a lot of wealth and knowledge in the industry. And obviously, as you'll hopefully read in the November issue, part one of Kevin's interview with Steve and Brian, they kind of talk a lot about how the industry has changed in their time. And I won't take too much more away from Kevin talking about how that conversation went. But yeah, definitely a unique opportunity being able to talk to two sort of titans in the industry.
Yeah, I was fortunate to be able to go down to Sykes Supply. It's where we had this meeting hosted in Burlington, North Carolina. I guess it would have been back at the end of August. Sykes Supply is one of several companies, as I understand it, that Steve Zelnak, the former chairman and CEO of Martin Marietta, is now a part of. You know, Steve was very gracious with his time. He brought in, like you said, a former competitor there in North Carolina, in Brian Full, whose history essentially goes all the way back to Western New York, where they're not present anymore. But, you know, Brian Full made the decision for Sunrock, you know, many years ago to venture down into North Carolina and compete with companies like Martin Marietta and other ones that identified that there was growth opportunity in the Tar Heel state. It was really interesting having those two guys in a room. I'm not sure exactly how many years combined they've been in the industry, but you're probably talking about 80 to 100 years of executive level leadership between those two guys, Brian and Steven. And, you know, we had others in the room from Pit and Quarry, from Psych Supply, from Sun Rock. And I guess as you and I are typically going out and about collecting information, you know, we're doing interviews and I found myself not doing a whole lot of talking because you got guys with a lot of experience, you know, and those two who were imparting their knowledge and swapping stories, sharing laughs. So I probably only asked a handful of questions and Brian and Steve were reminiscing. And, you know, it was really interesting. I found talking afterwards with the Sykes and Sun Rock folks, how they were just taking that in, the fact that, you know, you had these two giants of our industry in the room together talking about how the industry has changed. They talked about a lot of different things. I mean, they talked about people and how our industry isn't really well understood. But, you know, I know Brian and Steve were talking about the idea that, you know, you bring somebody into a quarry for a job and you know, they might not know anything, but you're going to marvel them when they see the fact that the tire on the haul truck that is running through the quarry is taller than them. They're going to marvel at the size and scope of the plant and how much material is coming out. You know, those are things that we need to do better as an industry promoting, you know, in order to bring people in. But you know, it was really cool to hear the evolution of the industry from the 1980s to today and how, you know, Steve and Martin married at the time and the things that he was trying to do. And Brian at Sunrock is still trying to do because he's still involved. And I think he's been active with his company, his family company, for 50 years. Astounding when you think about it. That was really an awesome opportunity. It's one you can read about in our November and December issues with parts 1 and 2. Yeah, and it was really a cool opportunity to kind of sit down again with Steve Zelnak, who's a member of the Pit and Quarry Hall of Fame. You know, Steve joined our Hall of Fame back in 2016 with Don James and Rick Feltus, and the Pit and Quarry Hall of Fame is ongoing. We're going to have that here again in March of 2024 at Ag One. So good to catch up with those guys and knowing Steve a little bit, again, from the Hall of Fame and kind of getting a sense of Brian, just having met him there. There's a time where, as an editor or the guy doing the interview, and you do this too, I mean, you just sit back and you let the source do the talking. Those sorts of interviews are the easy ones to do at the end of the day.
Yeah, it makes our job a little easier when they kind of take the ball and run with it. And I'll have people that'll be like, oh, sorry, you know, I talk too much. I'm like, no, listen, you just answered like 5 of my questions, so this interview is going to be about half the time it would need to be, so appreciate it.
Yeah. Now and then, I mean, you get an interview with somebody who, I'm not sure what your process is exactly, Jack, but I'll tend to kind of jot down some topics or questions and, you know, say it's 1 through 10 and start with number 1. And then you get somebody talking 40, 45 minutes, the interview's done. You don't have to jump in at all.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's almost times where I'll be in those situations. And like you said, I'll have a list of questions and I might ask one and then, you know, they'll answer a handful of them and then I'll ask another and they'll answer another handful. And I'm sort of sitting there after asking 2 questions and I'm like, all I got for you. Like you hit everything I wanted to talk about. And I, you know, it's a funny, awkward kind of feeling where you're like, yes, 2 questions, but they're so thorough that, you know, you get everything you need as an interviewer and a reporter. But yeah, definitely know that feeling well.
Well, I touched earlier this episode about greenfields and M&A as kind of a means to growth. And that was kind of a talking point that surfaced at Psych Supply when Brian and Steve were kind of swapping stories. And I asked those guys, you know, how do you feel like the aggregate industry is situated at this point in time here in 2023? And I know Steve Zelnak, he kind of took his answer in one specific direction. He was talking about how the window is closing a little bit in certain markets. And, you know, I've seen this over the years as I travel. You know, I think about the Denver market and Nashville. It's another bustling one that you and I were in recently. And there's no shortage of aggregates out there, but the aggregates aren't necessarily where we would like them to be. Kind of what Steve and Brian were talking about during their get together was how those companies, you know, Martin Marietta at the time and the Sun Rock Group, they identified that the Raleigh-Durham area, that these key metros in North Carolina were going to be high growth areas in the decades to come. You know, that's why Brian Full at the end of the day decided, you know, to leave Western New York. Like, their days of glory were in the past. You know, it's a high tax state. You hear about that nowadays, and we still hear about population fleeing that state and moving into higher growth areas. You know, North Carolina still seems like it. there's opportunity there. And you still see, you know, young people and an interest in moving to North Carolina. But, you know, again, Steve talked about how the window is closing, how the most ideal aggregate reserves were permitted, put online. And again, it kind of reinforces the idea that there's only so many opportunities out there to greenfield a quarry to get it going today, because there's such resistance in these metros. And, you know, Brian just happened to get in on it at the right time. He talked about studying demographics. I think it was Rand McNally, he said he was looking at, you know, back in the day, as kind of a resource to identify, you know, what are the high growth areas of the United States going to be in. And he came to the conclusion that that part of North Carolina was going to take off. And luckily for him, it has. Interesting to kind of get into a market that, you know, had a Martin Marietta when Steve was there. He took the company public in 1994, I believe. And so while you identify a market as an opportunity for growth, you may not be the only one. You know, you've got Martin Marietta and other players there. But again, sometimes the growth of a market provides enough for everybody, and it seems like that's the case ongoing here in 2023 for producers in metro areas of North Carolina.
Yeah, you know, and I think just to your point, it's been a while since I've seen one personally myself, but I know every once in a while we'll get reports that will kind of look at top performing crushed stone states, top performing sand and gravel states, and they're sort of the to be expected ones, you know, the Texases, the Californias, the Floridas. But again, being a Cleveland, Ohio based company, I always kind of feel a little vindicated when maybe Ohio gets shown in there, another Midwestern state, or maybe a Nashville gets shown, a place that you might not immediately think of as, you know, sort of a powerhouse state in this kind of regard. So it has been definitely interesting as someone who's still kind of learning the industry a little bit, seeing where some of these hotspots are starting to pop up, and a very cool experience to, again, be able to talk with them and kind of get that viewpoint of, you know, shifting from such a big state, going from New York to Nashville, and, you know, just a very cool case study in the way the industry is kind of molding itself into, you know, into what it looks like now.
Yeah, and in Brian's case, in Sunrock's case, they're not just limited to North Carolina. They've got a company in Canada. So again, just like I was talking about earlier with Minneapolis and the Kramer story, it seems like those who want to grow, who are hungry, they're going to find a way. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about, I think, at the beginning of this episode too. It's hard to find equipment. It isn't necessarily readily available by, you know, vendor one, vendor two that you may work with, but, you know, those vendors may work the problem with you. You know, there's solutions out there. You used the word creativity or creative earlier, Jack, and I think that applies on just about every front that our readers operate, you know, whether it's on the CapEx side with equipment and technology, or on the business side and trying to find ways to grow the business to sell more materials. We do have very creative readers at Pitt & Quarry.
Yeah, and I think, you know, speaking of that creativity, I think one of the spots where I think that can, or at least the ideals of that can really shine through, is, like you mentioned earlier, at the National Stone, Sand, and Gravel Association's Legislative and Policy Forum that you and our publishers, Rob and Dino, went to. I know it's an event you guys have been going to for a while now. I haven't had the opportunity to go yet, but, you know, this was kind of an interesting year, an interesting time to go, with some of the drama going on in D.C. between the potential shutdown that was ultimately averted, with the Speaker of the House drama going on. So, you know, I'm curious, how did this year kind of stack up to past years, sort of with all the external stuff going on?
Yeah, it seems like every year, or maybe at least every other year, there's some sort of story going on. And the Legislative and Policy Forum that you're talking about, that's an event that Pitt & Quarry participates in every year. And we have good partners at the National Stone, Sand, and Gravel Association who put on that event. And they actually put on that event in Washington jointly with a couple of other construction materials associations this year. Yeah, it's interesting, the backdrop of having, you know, a potential government shutdown looming when you're walking into the office of a congressman or a senator. And those topics did kind of surface when we were meeting with their staffers and the legislators. And in a way, you know, it kind of serves as a distraction. I think that event, we were going over to the Hill across two different days this year, Tuesday and Wednesday, I believe. And I think there was a deadline Friday at midnight to avoid a government shutdown. And we did avoid that. And yeah, I mean, it's just funny. At least those are icebreakers when you're walking into somebody's meeting, talking about the things that you need them to support you on as an aggregate producer, you know, or for us at Pitt & Quarry, being an advocate of our industry. It's an event, you know, going to Washington, walking the halls of Capitol Hill, is something that I've always kind of enjoyed. I can't tell you how many times I've done it. I think I've lost count. Here at North Coast Media, Pitt and Corey's parent company, I used to have the opportunity to do that with LP Gas magazine, which is our propane publication here at North Coast Media. It's a cool experience. I remember it was intimidating when I was a little bit younger and in my 20s, and you're sitting across from a senator and you're still kind of figuring out what it is your industry does in full, and you're trying to lobby for it. But at the end of the day, going into their offices, you know, these are the people that you see on TV, that you read about in the newspapers, you know, some of the big names. Being from Ohio, we would go around visiting with Ohio legislators. So we went into Jim Jordan's office. And it's kind of interesting looking back, you know, now he's making a run for the speakership as we're recording this episode. So yeah, it's kind of wild when you think about the fact that you're either sitting across from them or you're in their office or a staffer on their behalf is visiting with you and talking about the needs of our industry in terms of what Crushed Stone, Sand, and Gravel is asking legislators in Washington to do on their behalf.
Yeah, and obviously, like we kind of mentioned, a lot of other external stuff going on at the time. And you kind of hit on it in your November story that's going to be coming out, writing about the LPF. You kind of noted some of the legislators and congresspeople that you and the group were able to speak with and interact with a little bit. So I'm curious, you know, even with all of the sort of external stuff going on, how was it this year talking with the legislators, trying to get the industry's message across? You know, was it a receptive conversation? How did it stack up?
Yeah, there are a lot of issues that NSSGA briefed its membership, those of us who went on to Capitol Hill to talk about with legislators, probably a dozen or so issues. And our group from Ohio, there were probably 10 or 12 of us, headed by Pat Jackamit, the executive director of the Ohio Aggregates and Industrial Minerals Association. And Pat does a great job for OAIMA and a great job leading our contingent on Capitol Hill. But we focus on three key issues with legislators. And, you know, we talked about MSHA and what they're trying to do with silica. It seems like they're still trying to figure out what that rule is. I know they had a comments period back in September where they're receiving feedback from the aggregate industry, not just aggregates, but mining as a whole and other stakeholders who want to have some input on that rule. So we're basically advocating for that rule to kind of be a little bit dissimilar on the metal, non-metal side where our industry operates versus coal, which has more issues with silicosis. So we're hopeful that we're going to see a rule emerge from MSHA when the time comes that looks a little bit different for metal, non-metal operators than coal operators. TBD on that front. We talked about WOTUS, that's the Waters of the U.S. rule, and I feel like it's not always the home run or headlining issue that we take into congressional offices every year, but we had some developments this year in an EPA case. It was Sackett versus EPA at the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court essentially ruled in favor of our industry and against EPA, but we saw some development after that ruling mid-year, I believe, where EPA kind of put another rule out there with the Army Corps of Engineers, and the rule has kind of a lack of clarity still on what a water body of the United States is. So we took that talking point to legislators again, and we're asking them to give us some clarity on what an actual water body is, not just for our industry, but for businesses alike. And we also talked about some of the issues that have been kind of plaguing the rail industry or rail transportation. Switching rail lines has kind of been problematic for anybody that's moving aggregates on rail in the last couple of years. And you know, the Surface Transportation Board has a proposed reciprocal switching rule out there that promotes competition and improves service. So we're kind of lobbying for that to ease some pain that's being felt on the rail transportation front. I think one of the reasons why we go every year and why NSSGA and their partner organizations are out there year to year on the Hill is just to remind our legislators who we are. We're not a big industry. You know, there's about 10,000 quarries in the United States. That may seem like a lot, but when you think about those relative to, you know, communities, I guess we're just not that big of an industry. There's not necessarily as many dollars behind the aggregates industry as there are other industries like mining. You know, there's a lot of money in some of those lobbies. And we do have a strong lobby with NSSGA, but it's just so important as NSSGA is advising us just to be out there and talking about these issues. Because if we're not talking about these issues on Capitol Hill, then other industries' issues are going to be taking the priority. And it's just so important to be out there making relationships with legislators. And I can't say that I did see familiarity with some of our issues and some of the people who were revisiting Congress people for the second, third, fourth time. And it's good, especially because we're seeing turnover each congressional session with freshmen who need to learn our industry if they don't know anything about it already.
Yeah. And, you know, I obviously haven't had the chance to get out there yet. Certainly is something I would love to be able to experience. I kind of feel like kind of similar to how you do it first, a bit maybe intimidated, you know, meeting with all these people that, you know, you might see on TV or read about or sort of hear about, and all these sort of powerful people in the nation's capital. But yeah, you know, I think being able to, like you said, being able to be a part of giving this industry a stronger voice and being one of those voices, I think is, you know, important for us to do. Obviously, we cover what is actively going on, but I think also using our voice to sort of help bolster the industry as well is important. So yeah, glad that it was a good trip and looking forward to, you know, hopefully getting out there in the next year or two to experience it for myself.
Yeah, it'd be a good one. DC is a little chaotic right now, it seems. There's a lot transpiring, but the experience of getting to walk those halls and, you know, lobby on behalf of our industry, that's a valuable experience and one that we want to get for you. Well, I guess that's going to do it for episode two of Drilling Deeper, a Pit and Quarry podcast. Jack, it's been fun. We'll do this again here soon, and look forward to seeing everybody on a podcast again soon.
Yeah, and in the meantime, be sure to visit pitandquarry.com, check out our website, check out our socials, sign up for our e-newsletters, find us any way you can. We're out there, so check us out.